This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January 10th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, President Obama chooses his chief of staff, Jack Lew, to head the Treasury Department, but some express concern about his ties to Wall Street. Farmers take Monsanto to federal court seeking protection from lawsuits and genetically modified seeds. And we'll go to Germany, where tens of thousands of refugees are stuck in legal limbo. Some have taken to the streets to highlight their calls for asylum. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Three Kurdish activists were shot dead overnight inside the Kurdish Information Center in Paris, France. It's widely suspected the killings were politically motivated. FSRN's Lili Eskenazi reports.
Among the three women killed was Sakin Kansiz, the co-founder of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK. The separatist group has led a decades-long insurgency against the Turkish government. The other two victims were Kurdistan National Congress representative Fidan Dogan and Leyla Soylemez, a young Kurdish activist. All were shot in the head. As news of the killings spread, hundreds of Kurds in Paris gathered outside the information center to protest. They chanted in support of the PKK. There's wide speculation about the motivation for the killings. Turkish officials have suggested an internal feud within the PKK. Protesters blame Turkey for the assassinations. The killings come as the Turkish government and jailed PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan are negotiating a peace deal. The tentative plan, reported Tuesday, includes eventual disarmament in exchange for greater rights for Turkey's Kurdish minority. Lili Eskenazi, FSRN, Marseille.
A major bomb blast in Pakistan's Swat Valley has left more than 20 people dead. The explosion appeared to target a religious center that has traditionally been left alone by local militant groups. FSRN's Gabe Matthews reports.
46-year-old Aegis Khan traveled in cold weather to the mosque in Swat to attend a weekly religious gathering. He was near the spot where the bomb exploded and still has two family members who are missing.
I was coming out of the mosque when there was an explosion. I didn't know what was happening. I saw a huge flash and lost control of my body. I fell down but was conscious, and I knew it was a bomb. I felt extreme pain in my leg, and I asked people around me to take me to the hospital.
The blast killed 23 people and left more than 70 injured. This is the first attack on the preaching center in Swat. Most Taliban militants have respected the center's religious leaders in the past. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. I'm Janine Etter, reading for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan.
In related news from Pakistan, a pair of bombings at a market and billiards hall in the southwest city of Quetta killed at least 20 people today. BBC reports a Balochistan separatist group has claimed responsibility for the attack. After days of stalemate and protests, a prominent Chinese newspaper is back on newsstands today. Editors at the Southern Weekly reached a deal with state propaganda departments after earlier denouncing government censorship. Charges that the censors had radically altered the magazine's New Year's address sparked employee and reader protests in Guangzhou, where the paper is headquartered. For FSRN, Rebecca Valley has more from Beijing.
In this week's edition of the liberal magazine Southern Weekly, there was no direct mention of the dispute that triggered anti-censorship protests earlier this week. Online reports say that this was part of a Wednesday deal reached with state propaganda departments. Censors had made a key editorial change to last week's edition. After editors denounced the interference, they demanded that the local propaganda chief be dismissed. Officials did not answer that call, and neither sides publicized the information about their negotiations. David Bandersky heads the China Media Project in Hong Kong, a website that tracks media and censorship in China.
This could send a message to other propaganda leaders, local propaganda leaders, especially across the country, that you can't meddle with media like this. There are limits to control, and do not step over those lines, because they don't want to create another incident like this.
This week's edition of the Southern Weekly carried several hard-hitting reports on economic and environmental issues, a trademark of the publication. Rebecca Valli, Free Speech Radio News, Beijing.
A Vietnamese court has sentenced 14 pro-democracy activists to prison terms ranging from 3 to 13 years. A rights group and the U.S. Embassy are now criticizing the verdict. FSRN's Mike Ives reports from Vietnam.
The court found the activists guilty Wednesday of attending a training course on nonviolent struggle organized by the U.S.-based dissident group Viet Thanh, and for protesting against China's territorial claims in the South China Sea. The U.S. Embassy called for the activists' immediate release and said the verdict is inconsistent with Vietnam's obligations under international law. Phil Robertson, deputy director of the Asia Division at Human Rights Watch, said the 14 activists were targeted for speaking out about land grabs and religious freedom.
Once again, we have the Vietnam government imprisoning people for crimes that shouldn't be crimes.
In other news Wednesday, an eighth-grade student in central Vietnam was suspended for a year after posting a Facebook message that parodied one of Ho's revolutionary speeches. Mike Ives, FSRN, Hanoi.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today, President Barack Obama announced the nomination of White House Chief of Staff Jack Lew to replace outgoing Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner.
Jack has the distinction of having worked and succeeded in some of the toughest jobs in Washington and the private sector. As a congressional staffer in the 1980s, he helped negotiate the deal between President Reagan and Tip O'Neill to save Social Security. Under President Clinton, he presided over three budget surpluses in a row. So for all the talk out there about deficit reduction, making sure our books are balanced, this is the guy who did it.
The former director of the Office of Management and Budget pledged to work towards a, quote, sound economy and a safer world, but some have criticized Lew's time in the private sector. The watchdog group Public Citizen expressed concern about Lew's deep Wall Street connections, noting his previous work at Citigroup. Speaking at the National Democratic Institute in September, Lew praised controversial international trade agreements in Asia and Latin America and pushed for opening markets around the world.
We're harnessing our economic power, finalizing trade pacts with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea to increase U.S. exports, expanding trade with emerging powers from Brazil to India to Indonesia, working to open new markets for American businesses, increasing exchanges and collaborations in science and technology, and pursuing a high-standard trade pact in the Pacific that should be a model and will be a model for the world.
This week, more than 230,000 people signed a petition to urge President Obama to nominate Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman to head the Treasury Department, citing Krugman's prescience in predicting the housing bubble, his call for more job creation, and his opposition to cuts to Social Security and Medicare benefits. Jack Lew still needs to be confirmed by the Senate. In Washington, hundreds of organic and conventional farmers took the Monsanto Corporation to federal court on Thursday. They're asking the agribusiness giant to promise not to sue them for patent infringement should their crops get contaminated by neighboring genetically modified crops. But many food justice advocates want to go further. They're calling on the courts and Congress to revoke Monsanto's seed patents, label all genetically modified food, and better protect farmers from crop contamination. FSRN's Alice Olstein was in the courtroom this morning and brings us this report.
Monsanto's lawyers asked a panel of judges at D.C.'s federal appeals court to throw out the lawsuit against them. They said the farmer plaintiffs, who have never used Monsanto seeds or pesticides and have no intention of doing so, have no standing to sue. During the hearing, the company's attorney Seth Waxman said, "We've never heard of you people." But legal experts representing the farmers say they have a strong case. Though their crops haven't been contaminated and they haven't been threatened, the lawsuit notes that Monsanto has sued more than 140 other farmers for patent infringement over the past 16 years and extracted settlement payments from hundreds more out of court. Dan Ravitcher, an attorney with the Public Patent Foundation, said the judges should allow the case to proceed.
If we don't have standing today to seek protections of the courts, when will we have standing? Do we have to wait until we're contaminated? Do we have to wait until Monsanto threatens us? The case law clearly says no.
One of the lead plaintiffs in the case is Jim Gerritsen, an organic potato farmer from Maine. Outside the courthouse, Gerritsen told a crowd of supporters and demonstrators what to expect if the court grants him and other farmers legal standing.
One, we're seeking protection for family farmers that should they be trespassed upon by Monsanto, contaminated crops, that Monsanto will be prevented from suing us for patent infringement, claiming that we have possession of their patented technology. The second goal is we are challenging the basic validity of the transgenic, genetically engineered seed patents that were granted to Monsanto by the U.S. Patent Office. The people own the life forms. The corporations can't be allowed to continue to abuse them.
Farmers from Vermont, South Dakota, New Mexico, and other states across the U.S. came to Washington to participate in the demonstration outside the courthouse, which mainly focused on the negative impacts of GMO seeds on the environment and human health. While Monsanto's attorneys argued that it wasn't the court's place to weigh the pros and cons of genetically modified crops, Ravitch recounted that it's more about securing the necessary protections for his legally vulnerable clients.
Monsanto is never going to admit that their seed contaminated somebody else. They're never going to admit that because then they may be open to liability for that property damage that they've caused the organic farmer, because it takes an organic farmer 3 years to purge that contamination. So Monsanto is not going to admit that it's their fault that their seed contaminated an organic farmer. So they're always going to allege that you're a dirty, rotten thief.
The appeals court could rule any time within the next few months. But food justice advocates plan to use the upcoming presidential inauguration ceremony to raise awareness about Monsanto's practices and pressure the Obama administration to act. Lauren Stansbury is one of the organizers planning the protest.
4 years ago, President Obama, while he was campaigning for our votes, promised the American people that he would label GMOs. And not only has he failed to follow through on that promise, but he's actually enacted a policy that has combated our efforts to get GMOs labeled in the United States. He has appointed Michael Taylor, who was vice president of Monsanto's public policy, to be the food safety czar of the FDA. So basically, Obama has set up the one agency in the United States that is charged with protecting Americans' health and the food system, corroborating with Monsanto's overall strategy to keep us in the dark about what we're eating.
The January 21st action, led by the group Occupy Monsanto, will include marches, street theater, and recorded audio of Obama's promises on genetically modified food. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
After yesterday's State of the State address in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo captured headlines for a passionate speech about reducing gun violence and strengthening gun control laws. He also outlined plans for tourism, agriculture, and economy and education. He did not mention one of the most controversial issues the state is facing, whether to lift a moratorium on fracking. To put pressure on the governor and other elected officials, more than 1,000 people gathered at the Capitol to call for a ban on fracking. FSRN's Jim Crivo was there and brings you some of their voices.
Well, I've lived in New York State my entire life, always in rural New York, and I don't want to see our essential and crucial resources, which are fresh air, fresh water, and clean land. I don't want to see those sacrificed or put in danger and put in jeopardy for what will be a boom and bust economy that will leave us devastated.
You know, today's the governor's State of the State address. I think it would be fantastic if he could really be a governor for tomorrow rather than a governor of yesterday and divorce himself from this dependence or this relationship with fossil fuels and gas companies. I mean, I think this is such an incredible opportunity for the governor, and I hope he takes advantage of it.
You know, he chose not to talk about it at all today because of the amount of people that were outside. And I think it really hinges on some decisions that he needs to make, and he needs to think hard about it.
I'm here because I'm worried about the state of our water. When fracking comes here, I feel like it'll be poisoning their future, poisoning their water. My husband and I built our home, and we want to pass it on to our children. And when that's not going to be possible if our water is poisoned to the point that we can't drink it. I don't want them to get cancer. It's far more expensive to deal with cancer than it is to deal with renewable resources and changing our energy policies.
And what is your name?
My name is Quaylen, and I am here to ban fracking. I do not want the farms all around my house to get the cows polluted. I want fresh water, I want clean air, and that's why I'm here today.
You just heard protesters in Albany, New York, singer Natalie Merchant and her husband, John Bauermaster, Wes Gillingham with the environmental group Catskill Mountain Keeper, and Stephanie Redman and her son, Quaylen. The State Assembly is holding a public hearing on fracking today, and some lawmakers are urging the governor to extend the comment period on the latest fracking regulations, which ends tomorrow. Intense storms hit the Mideast this week, leading to major flooding in Israel, the deaths of four Palestinians in the West Bank, and dozens of injuries in Gaza. Today, snow blanketed many areas, but the rare opportunity to play in the snow turned violent after Israeli settlers attacked Palestinian youth near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. FSRN's Ghassan Banora reports.
In two separate incidents, armed Israeli settlers attacked Palestinian families enjoying the snow in the villages of Kassara and Burin. Medical sources reported that three young men were injured in Burin. One was hit with a live round in his leg and two others from tear gas inhalation. A fourth young man from the village of Kassara was shot with a live round, though the extent of his injuries was unclear. Residents of the two villages said that the settlers attacked them because they were playing with the snow near the Israeli settlements of Ish Kodesh and Yitzhar. The settlements are considered illegal under international law. At both locations, the Israeli army aided the settlers and fired tear gas at the unarmed Palestinian villagers. Abdel Karim Al-Saadi is a researcher for the Israeli human rights group Beit Salem in Nablus city. He says the settlers' attacks are not isolated incidents.
Settler attacks have increased lately, targeting villagers around Nablus, especially to the east of the city near the settlement of Yitzhar.
Israeli police also attacked Palestinian children and youth playing with snow in the city of Jerusalem and arrested two. Youth began throwing rocks after settlers shouted and cursed at them. Snow is a relatively a big event in Palestine, as people here rarely get to enjoy it about once every 10 years. Ghassan Banoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
In Germany, a group of refugees and their supporters in Berlin have taken over an abandoned school building as part of a protest against the treatment of asylum seekers. The group is demanding changes in Germany's immigration laws and an end to deportations. FSRN's Kelly Benjamin has more.
For almost a month now, several dozen refugees from Africa, Central Asia, and the Middle East have been squatting in the former Gerhard Hauptmann Primary School in the Kreuzberg district of Berlin. The group of political asylum seekers and their supporters are part of a coalition group called Refugee Strike, which in recent weeks has been escalating their struggle against what they say are xenophobic and racist laws regarding immigration to Germany.
We just want to live like normal people.
Al-Nur Hassan is a refugee from the Darfur region of Sudan. After fleeing violence in his village, he found his way to Germany 9 months ago, where he was interned in a refugee camp, or lager.
In Deutschland, the situation of the people playing asylum, it's very bad situation. As you know, even some people, they kill themselves because of all of this situation, especially the freedom of movement, because you don't have freedom of movement to move. Just you have paper, you have to stay in one area. It's not allowed to come. But I came here because I'm asking about my right, the freedom of movement, and to close all the lagers.
Activists with Refugee Strike claim that the lagers, or refugee camps in Germany, are run like prisons and that asylum seekers are treated inhumanely and denied access to social services, healthcare, and freedom of movement. Although there have been some improvements, such as a raise in refugee aid benefits in July of 2012, most of Germany's 130,000 refugee seekers live in a legal limbo without protected status. Many of them wind up deported back into war zones. According to the Berlin Initiative Against Deportations, Germany deports over 50,000 migrants and asylum seekers each year. Last September, over 100 refugees and supporters marched 500 kilometers from the German town of Würzburg to Berlin to bring attention to their demands. The march culminated in the establishment of a refugee encampment in the main plaza in Kreuzberg. The group has also won sympathy from the Green Party mayor of Kreuzberg, Franz Schulz, who has instructed the police not to shut down the encampment.
We are here, and we will fight. Freedom of movement is everybody's right.
We are here,
just before Christmas, a contingent of refugees from Afghanistan and their supporters made their way to the Afghanistan embassy in Berlin to demand their right to asylum. Among them was Farid Mirzai, who fled Afghanistan after his village was bombed by the Taliban 4 years ago. Mirzai traveled through five countries before landing in Germany.
He asked Karzai, "If can you promise that this young, when come back to their country, won't be killed by the, you know, the Taliban, the bomb, the creek?" The future of the young people are corrupted, and can you promise that this future will be okay for us in Afghanistan? We see just krieg and war and guns in our future in Afghanistan, nothing more.
Outside the Afghan embassy, a tense exchange occurred between Mirzai and officials who came outside to greet the protesters. The officials, who refused to give their names, said the situation in Afghanistan is stabilizing. Mirzai produced gruesome photos from his bombed-out village and begged to differ. Over 11,000 Afghanis came to Germany last year seeking asylum, but according to the German government, many of them do not meet the criteria for asylum, despite living in a country where armed violence and bomb attacks are regular occurrences. Refugee strikes' occupation of the abandoned school building in Kreuzberg and continued protests against the German government has helped to elevate the plight of refugees and their demands in Germany. Mayor Schulz has also said he will allow the refugees to stay in the school building at least until March, when winter is over. Kelly Benjamin, FSRN, Berlin, Germany.
We now turn to a deeper look at the immigration laws in Germany. According to the UN's refugee agency, there are more than 500,000 refugees in Germany. About 60,000 of those are seeking asylum, but it's a process that can last years. And in the meantime, legal advocates say conditions for refugees in terms of access to employment, aid, and education are poor. For more, we're joined by Karl Kopp, Director of European Affairs with the organization Pro Asyl, a legal aid organization based in Frankfurt. Welcome to FSRN.
Hello, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
What are the restrictions in place now for those who are seeking asylum? Can they work? Do they have free movement? What are the conditions like?
The German authority created 20 years ago a very tough asylum system. So, for example, if you seek for asylum in Germany, you are distributed. Maybe you will end up in a camp in the middle of nowhere in the Bavaria or in the eastern part of Germany, and you are not allowed to leave the district during the whole asylum procedure. This is very tough, and you are not allowed to work during the first year, and during the following years it's very restricted. So it's a kind of disintegration program from day one on.
So what you're describing, the restrictions on movement, the living conditions, how long does a process typically take for somebody who is applying for asylum?
It depends. As for example, a few years ago we had very low numbers, figures, less than 20,000 asylum seekers. Well, this is nothing. And so it was possible to get a high-speed decision, also in a positive way. Now we have, let's say, little by little more asylum seekers, more than 60,000 this year. And then it's possible that you wait for a month or more than a year for your first interview, and you wait in a camp, yeah, and you are not allowed to move, and you are not allowed to learn the language. Yeah, you can learn the language privately, but there is no offer by the authorities to support you to start a first integration process during the asylum procedure. This is not foreseen.
And what does someone need to prove in order to be granted asylum status?
This is a very difficult question because, okay, at the moment, if you are an asylum seeker from Syria, you have a 90% chance to get a refugee status. So it's a high recognition rate. But the process is very slowly, so you wait for a long period maybe. In former times, Afghan refugees in the 90s, they did not get a refugee status. They were only tolerated because of very restrictive application of the 1951 convention, refugee convention.
You use the term tolerated person. What does that mean legally?
And tolerated means only in this moment we are not able to deport you. You are not legal and are not totally illegal, but you live in between. And you have very restricted social living conditions. And you wake up in the morning and think maybe the deportation will come next day.
And how many people are there in Germany who have this status?
More than 60,000, more than 80,000.
In 2012, the German Constitutional Court ruled that social benefits that asylum seekers receive was inadequate. Your organization was part of that case. Has that improved since then?
The government is obliged to grant asylum seekers more money, more support, more also especially for minors, for kids. So this is a first step of improvement. But the next step would be to change this Asylum Seeker Benefit Act in a way that they don't get in future their support in kind.
A moment ago in the story from Berlin, we heard voices of several people, a man from Sudan, another from Afghanistan. We also heard that one of the challenges that asylum seekers face is that they are required to return to the country where they first entered Europe in order to seek asylum. That policy is called the Dublin Regulation. How does that work, and what is the impact on people in Germany?
It's a hell. Dublin, it's a European regulation. At the moment, we have, let's say, last year, 3,000 deportations back to another EU country. For only one purpose, you are obliged to pass your asylum procedure there. And the authorities in former times did not take care of what will happen on the other side. This regulation shifts the responsibility concerning refugee protection to the poorer countries, to the not so well-equipped asylum countries, at the external borders.
Karl Kopp is Director for European Affairs with the organization Pro Asyl. That's a human rights organization based in Frankfurt. He joined us to discuss the refugee policy in Germany and in the region. Karl Kopp, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. All the best.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kamp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Our Washington, D.C. intern is James Helmsworth. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.